This podcast is rated S for science and also for spoilers and swearing. There's going to be swearing.
Something is killing these people and sucking them dry.
Run! It's a stampede!
Okay, welcome everybody, one and all, to Cinematica Animalia, the podcast where we go through somebody's favourite movie, monster, animal, riffraff, violent adolescent amphibian, and break down how they might work in the real world due to their ecology and physiology. My name is Sam Perrin of EcologyForTheMasses.com. And the Norwegian University of Science and Technology, and today we are looking at the gremlins. But before we get into that, with me soon is pod co-host
and
co-author at Ecology for the Masses, Adam Hysack, who is just joining us now. Say hi to everyone, Adam.
Hi, everyone. Just coming.
With me also today is Dave, our vet friend from Canada. Not with us again today is Taekwon Jr. I believe it's actually Taekwon the Third. Dave, I think you know where Taekwon is this week?
Yeah, unfortunately this week he couldn't make it. He's currently trying to teach ants how to speak Mandarin.
Oh, that's so much better than being stuck in a beaver dam.
It's quite an undertaking. I didn't get exactly what the details with the project were, but he promises it has nothing to do with world domination. And would prefer that we just don't talk about it, if at all possible.
That's what I always tell people about the insects I work with for my work. Definitely not training them to be attack dragonflies.
Okay, so, like I said, today we're looking at the gremlins. No, hang on, before we do that, anybody got any news? Dave, you got a PSA for us. What do you want us to do to our pets?
What I want you to do to your pets?
Yeah. Blow coke up their ass.
What do you want to do with your pets,
I guess,
baby?
The best one that I can start with is just simply fighting off like two rumors that we keep running into, and I think people need to be more aware of them. One is more Canada-specific, and the other one is just everywhere. So the first is you'll see a lot of information online that if your animal gets porcupine quills in its face, to try to cut the porcupine quills to make it easier to remove them. That is not the case. Porcupine quills are these little inflated devices, and if you cut them, you completely break their integrity. And then when you come into the vet and we've got all these like broken porcupine quills and you're trying to pull them free, they basically break apart into a million tiny little pieces inside of your poor dog.
Great.
Yes, and they will migrate. The skin has no ability to actually push a porcupine quill out, which some people think. So instead, it pulls it through from one side to the other. So it is not uncommon to have an animal in that has had porcupine quills and is now in a situation where they've migrated into the throat or into the chest or into other areas where we have to figure them out.
Let me guess, that's not good.
Not good. But the one that I wanted to bring up, just because we saw a whole bunch of cases this week, there's a whole bunch of information floating around online that you are supposed to give your dog hydrogen peroxide to make it vomit. This is true. It will make them vomit. However, a lot of times it doesn't, and then we've got to deal with hydrogen peroxide still in their stomach. And if they do vomit, they can actually aspirate the hydrogen peroxide, which does have nasty acidic properties to it, which can affect lung tissue, can lead to hydrogen peroxide burns. It's just generally not a good thing to do. So in an emergency situation, it is something you can do to induce vomiting, but it's far better to just go into your vet and then they just get an injection of something called apomorphine that just causes them to vomit really easily. So please stop giving them hydrogen peroxide.
Don't poison your pets.
Yeah, I guess the news last couple of weeks, the California wildfires have been huge.
Yeah,
real bad.
So we had a piece on Ecology for the Masses this week about the fire suppression regime that happened in the early half of the 20th century, where Americans were just basically like, no, we don't want wildfires at all. We don't want wildfires at all anywhere. And that's kind of dangerous, because in California and in the state I'm from in Australia as well, Victoria, the landscape's adapted to fires occurring on a, you know, semi-regular basis. Not once every, you know, couple of years, that which is happening now, but, you know, once every, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 years, a big one every decade, that sort of thing. And so because the landscape's adapted to that sort of stuff, it's good for it, you know. leads to regeneration, new growth, that sort of thing, biodiversity.
Mm-hmm.
But what the US did out west was essentially create this enormous homogenous landscape that never experienced fire. And so these days when it goes up. Like it's, yeah.
Yeah, because isn't there a lot really of, there's some consideration right now to start taking on Finland's behavior for stopping wildfires, right?
Just permanently being at negative 20 degrees all year. Yeah, I heard that works really well. I heard that like kills wildfires straight away if you're just stuck at negative 20 degrees for the entire year and your population's a bunch of miserable assholes.
I was more referring to the raking of the wildfires as stated by Adam's president, but yes.
See, I thought what they did was train the reindeer to do it for them, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
There's only so many reindeer you can get pissing on a wildfire.
Today, we may think of them as mythical creatures, but did you know that gremlins may, in fact, be real?
Anyway, so, how this is going to work today is that Dave is going to give us a quick history of the gremlins in cinema, and the important points we need to know about them going forward. We're just going to have a brief discussion of what we thought of the film. And then we will continue on to the physiology. Dave will take us through the physiology of the gremlins. And then Adam and I will go through their ecology. We'll then have a nice little versus at the end, which I'm quite proud of. And I can't believe you guys haven't guessed yet, but it'll be good fun. Take us away, Dave.
Perfect. So just as like a brief overview, gremlins have obviously been around long before the film came along. The earliest records that we have actually come from the Second World War. And became a big term that we saw with a lot of members of the Royal Air Force, so the basically the British pilots that stationed in Malta, the Middle East, and India.
Carrot boys.
So they started coming up with gremlins as a word to refer to inexplicable accidents, which sometimes occurred during their flights. And so originally the idea was actually that gremlins were, you know, enemy sympathizers. They were working against the British. But interestingly enough, in interactions with captured German pilots and with, you know, pilots from the other side, they found that they also suffered from inexplicable accidents. And the Germans actually brought some of this material in terms of like there was some form of exchange. Rumors got traded and both sides sort of developed their own gremlin legends. Still, again, primarily within the Royal Air Force, but the idea ended up springing up that the gremlins were basically these evil creatures that came along and just acted out of mischief in their own self-interest. Now, interestingly, a lot of historians have actually said gremlins were one of the best things to come along for the Royal Air Force, because looking back, a lot of this damage was caused by pilots, you know, incompetently trying to work on these planes without good training in situations where, you know, they would be drunk and they would be attempting to do fixes. And that if they hadn't had basically the gremlins for the two of them to like everybody to team up against, you would have created this situation where the pilots would have been fighting with each other instead of basically redirecting all their energy towards these, you know, fictional creatures. So, yeah, so the actual like main publishing that everybody thinks about was Roald Dahl, who in 1942 ended up finding himself transferred to Washington, D.C. as part of the British Embassy. He had served in the Royal Air Force, and he ended up bringing along the concept of the gremlins with him and ended up writing a story basically about the gremlins, who were tiny men who lived on the Royal Air Force fighters. They did have wives that were called the Fifinellas. They had male children called Widgets and female children called Flibbergibbets.
Flibbergibbets.
Yeah. And anyways,
they're made up words.
Yeah, so he ended up getting in touch with Walt Disney, a sort of project came about, and he ended up publishing a 1943 book called The Gremlins.
Okay.
Now, the book was supposed to become a movie or an animated short, never ended up making it that far, and instead ended up just becoming a very successful book. Interestingly enough, in the books, the gremlins ended up living in the swamps of England originally, and then moving themselves into the hangars. Their food source was actually postage stamps. they seem to have this sort of like uneven social structure, and their intelligence was pretty much like comparable to children in terms of what they had to go through. And there's actually a cool little reference to postage stamps in the movie that we'll get around to.
Okay. I missed that one.
Anyways, yeah, so gremlins continued to live on in North American as well as sort of generalized popularized society. One of the biggest examples being the 1963 episode of The Twilight Zone, Nightmare at 20,000 Feet.
It's a great episode.
In which
did a Simpsons episode on that.
Yeah,
right?
And it's a great episode in terms of a man flying on a plane ends up seeing this creature which looks nothing like the gremlins from the movies. It's kind of this morphed man that's out on the wing sort of tearing things apart. He becomes hysterical in that classic line of, you know, there's a gremlin on the wing, sort of being expressed as things are going along. And anyways, it ended up extending. Now, the movie itself ended up coming around and was conceived by a guy named Chris Columbus, no relation. Chris Columbus ended up getting the inspiration from apparently he had a really, really shitty loft that he lived in with a really bad pest problem. And he was often woken up at night by this like skittering noise in the darkness, which he thought was the scariest thing in the world because he knew they were out there destroying his stuff somehow. And he ended up taking inspiration from Roald Dahl and the other Gremlin stories and ended up designing his own version. Yeah.
But also, isn't the scientist played by Christopher Lee?
I believe, you're right.
Yeah. I'm sure that Christopher Lee is like the scientist in Gremlins 2.
He's the best.
It is, you're right. He plays Dr. Cushing. I totally forgot that. Yeah, so I'm not going to go into that in terms of like it's a bad film, and I think the first Gremlins stands on its own.
Yes, I skipped it. We're just focusing on the first Gremlins today. It gives us all we need to know,
and then just to show
there's a couple of interesting things in the second one, which is like when one of the Gremlins just switches gender, or switches sex out of nowhere.
So they're hermaphrodites.
Yes.
Which suggests that the gremlins had a sex, because I don't know if I thought that. Well, I don't know. Look, it doesn't matter.
We're
skipping that one.
Yeah. So in terms of the basic plot, Gremlin centers around a man, Randall Peltzer, who ends wandering into Chinatown to try and find a gift for his son. He's a struggling inventor who finds himself in a tiny little store where there's a creature called a Mogwai, which, interestingly enough, I hadn't realized in Cantonese means devil in terms of direct translation. The store owner refuses to sell it to him, but eventually he convinces the grandson to give it to him. And
grandson steals it from the grandfather.
Yeah, he steals it from
him. Grandson convinces. I thought the grandson convinced him.
No, he steals it from Mr. Wing. Mr. Wing doesn't want to sell it.
He's like, $200. He's like, you go on upstairs, I'll take care of this.
Yeah.
He just straight up steals it from his grandfather. And then I gotta love 80s racism in movies where he makes a comment, he's trying to sell this stupid bathroom caddy buddy that has like toothpaste, razor, mirror, everything in one. It's like, say you wake up on the plane, you've got dragon breath, and then you hear a gong. It's like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, and he looks down at a dragon statue because he realizes he's just said something very offensive, I hope.
Yeah.
So the three rules that are attached to owning a Mogwai are you can't get them wet, you can't expose them to sunlight, and you absolutely can't feed them after midnight.
Yes.
The Mogwai, nicknamed Gizmo, ends up becoming basically a gift to Randall's son Billy, whose main contribution in the film is that his dog is constantly being threatened by one of the most evil characters possibly to grace the screen, Mrs.
That
Deagle.
Oh my god, Jesus. Just so over the top too, like within the first 5 minutes she's denied like a lovely woman and her two poor starving children money.
Their house. She's kicking them out of their house.
She's refusing to let them delay a rent payment.
Yeah. She's kicking them out of their house. She does the whole, but it's Christmas. I don't give a fuck. So now you know what you need to ask.
Yeah.
She cuts in line twice.
Yeah.
That just... Oh.
And the employees keep serving her. It's not like you're some amazing patron. You're just a rich... You're the wife of a criminal who got money from the stock market, and you're just a terrible old woman. Mm.
Moving on.
That's gross.
Gizmo becomes a good pet. He's fairly intelligent. He seems to be
incredibly intelligent.
Readily.
Yeah, which is one of the problems that Adam and I are going to run into.
Yeah, they accidentally get him wet, leading to the transformation and production of another number of versions of himself, which seem to be evil. They seem to wreak havoc, including stringing up Billy's dog. Eventually,
By his neck when I first saw that.
It's pretty dark. They eventually end up finding themselves separated. Some of them continue to stay with Billy. One of them ends up with the local science teacher, Mr. Hansen. All of them end up getting accidentally fed after midnight through both trickery and just opportunity, which transforms them into the hard, scaly creatures known as gremlins. The gremlins seem to be a much different creature. They're nasty, they're evil, they turn on absolutely everything, and it leads to one of the greatest fight scenes in all of cinema, which is Billy's mom fighting the gremlins in the kitchen.
She's just straight into it.
No hesitation! Like, I would have to think about it and be like, all right, I'm going to push that gremlin into the microwave. She walks over without missing a beat, stuffs it into the microwave, and hits, like, the four-minute button. Like,
that was the one that was throwing plates. I think the first thing she ever did was, the one was, like, face first in there, in that orange juicer. And she's like, well, and turn this on and suck him down and blend the gremlin. The other one's throwing plates at her, and she backs into the microwave, slams the door, puts it on, it blows the fuck up. And then she's, there's one in the tree, her son cuts the head off, that's it.
She Christmas knifes.
Yeah.
Christmas knife.
She really, like, thinking on her feet, aggressive, brutal. Oh, yeah, half of me just wanted to put her in the verses today.
Yeah, she wrecks almost every single one of the newly formed gremlins, leading to Stripe having to go to the YMCA, like a village person. Yeah. He finds himself there where, following his jump into the water, creates a whole bunch of new gremlins that wreak havoc all over the town, leading to the death of a very sweet farm couple, which is a loss, but also the death of Miss Geagle, which is a huge win.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. One of the best cinema deaths I've ever seen.
Yeah. They eventually get trapped into a movie theater where Billy and his sort of girlfriend, Kate, who's dark.
Played by Phoebe Cates.
Yeah, who's great.
If you don't know who Phoebe Cates is, then
don't.
You're too young.
Yeah, don't tell them.
You are no longer our target demographic.
Anyways, they manage to trap them into a movie theater where they roast them alive in a brutal scene comparable to Kate's father dying in a chimney in a Christmas outfit and then getting accidentally set on fire by the family.
They Inglourious Basterds them.
And Stripe only manages to survive for his love of candy, leading to a brutal store fight trying to hunt him down. Where fuck
an amazing scene.
That chainsaw. That is one of the scariest moments in cinema.
The gremlin wielding a chainsaw is incredible.
Right.
Yeah.
Or using a gun.
Yeah. He wasn't the first one to do it either.
Yeah.
The one who understands like how a balaclava works, he's got like a balaclava like and a masked robber and almost mugs Phoebe Cates. It's just incredible. Yep. Oh my god.
Eventually it leads to Gizmo managing to dump a ton of sunlight onto Stripe shortly before he's able to reproduce and produce more evil gremlins. Mm-hmm. Gizmo effectively killing his son kind of indirectly, which is a little bit of a weird turn of events in the whole thing.
You gotta put that little shit down sometime.
Yeah, and leading to what I would sort of say is a semi-happy ending, where Mr. Wing ends up showing up at the end of the film and taking Gizmo back because he feels humanity is not quite ready for the gremlin yet, or at least North American society isn't.
Here, quickly! There's a man out there.
What?
Look, he's crawling on.
Okay, yeah, and you know what?
Mm-hmm. You know what?
This is a great movie.
It is.
It's so much fun.
It really
I
is.
I love this, yeah. I loved it. It was surprisingly dark. Like that scene
really
where
fucking dark.
Talking about her dad like dying in the chimney. It was just oh. God.
Even before that, whenever There's you first get the introduction to her, like not like in Christmas, and you're like, "What the fuck is wrong with you?" I mean, I understand why people maybe don't celebrate it because they have a different like religious belief or whatever. And she just acts like it's the most normal thing not to. It's like no. You need to justify this aversion you have to this huge cultural touchstone that is the Christmas holiday in the USA. But then she's like, yeah, you know, most people are opening presents. Other people are opening their wrists. It's like, what?
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the darkest lines
I've
ever
heard. Highest suicide
rate
is during the holidays. She just drops it into conversation.
Which, it comes up in some movies.
I don't think that's true.
I think it is, at least in the USA.
I'm pretty sure a high suicide rate is actually in, like, spring.
Oh.
The scene with his mom just straight up going for the gremlins, it's not only nice because it's not a helpless female character in a movie, even for the 80s, but I think it's a much more realistic portrayal of what someone would do when faced by like a life or death situation instead of this standing there like, oh, I don't understand what's going on. I'm going to sit here and wonder about this out loud for 5 minutes while these monsters do horrible things instead of me taking necessary steps for survival immediately.
Female characters at the time, we had a lot of films where like a mouse runs into the room and you've got four women climbing up onto a table screaming. And this mom walks into these creatures that would scare the shit out of me and just starts murking them left and right.
Yeah.
She's been watching Alien.
But so yeah, she's taken after Sigourney Weaver. Get away from her, you bitch.
Yeah. I thought they were going to use that line. Like, I was just waiting for it. Sitting there waiting for that line to pop up.
Because Aliens had come out 3 years before that, if only. But, Yeah. Also with a different and kind of still kind of tropey. So you have the horribly racist caricature of a old wise Chinese man. Then you also have the one person of color in the movie getting being the first one to be killed. But at least he's an intelligent character that's not just a stereotype.
Yeah.
Who was he?
The teacher.
Oh, of course. Yeah, yeah. He was a nice... And there's so many just likable people in this. Apart from old mate Mrs. Deagle. Yeah. And, speaking of Phoebe Cates, if you know the infamous scene I'm talking about, fucking Judd Reinhold's in this as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he pops up as the biggest douche ever. My God. It's like that whole line, look at me, I've got a maid, I'm doing this, I'll be senior partner by the time I'm 12, it'll be amazing. And then, yeah, it's just, oh my God.
You almost ended up applying for unemployment today.
That's just the character he always plays.
Your family. I'm like, this guy's supporting his family? Fucking give the guy a break. Like,
I mean, he was it's basically the same character he played in The Santa Claus, where he's just a smarmy psychologist who thinks he knows better than everybody else because Santa Claus isn't real, Tim Allen, even though you're Santa Claus now.
I just remember him as that great villain from, was it Beverly Hills Cop 3?
I don't know. I haven't seen those movies, actually.
Okay. Well, he's really good in that, too.
My happiest moment anytime I watch these is remembering that Corey Feldman plays it, because I always forget until he takes off the Christmas tree costume at the one part, and then I'm just like, ah!
Number one, he hates bright lights. We know that. But you got to keep him out of the sunlight. Number two, keep him away from water. And whatever you do, don't give him a bath. And probably the most important thing, don't ever feed him after midnight.
All right, so on to the physiology of the gremlins that day.
Yeah.
Good
so
luck.
The gremlins physiology, which it doesn't sound like you guys enjoyed the ecology aspect as much. I actually had a lot of fun with the physiology this week.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
this was there's a lot of stuff where I can just be like, this works or it doesn't, but a lot of it was just kind of fun. So I'm gonna try to sort of pick some major topics to start with. So the easiest being, I'm just gonna start, and I'm also gonna split up the Mogwais and the Gremlins. So the biggest things just simply being, for the Mogwais, I'm gonna talk about the three main rules: the sunlight allergy, the replication with water, and the transformation into the gremlins, you know, the eating after midnight kind of thing. So in terms of the Mogwai, sort of their general physiology, I'm sure you guys will get into this a little bit more. They are about a foot tall. They're going to have a metabolic rate probably similar to that of a dog or a cat, or a small dog or cat. They've got a fur coat suggesting that they are fairly warm, or they're coming from an environment that has at least some form of seasonality.
Yep.
They do have these incredibly huge eyes, these big, long, large ears. Yeah, and they're very sensitive hearing, and the YMCA, when the bell goes off, it seems to really upset Gizmo. their primary... They're what?
The light, too. Just bright lights in general.
Yeah. Their primary communication seems to be sort of like purring and singing, but they are able to pick up the English language very rapidly, suggesting that they are incredibly intelligent. Their dentition, they've got mostly sort of incisors that we can sort of see. There's no clear carnivorous teeth. So I would assume they're mostly omnivorous, with probably a little bit of some shift sort of back and forth, probably more of a hint towards herbivorous. They are strong, at least in numbers, enough that they can actually lift up a dog and put him into all those Christmas tree lights at one point.
Yeah.
They do have three digits on both their fingers and their feet. The Mogwais themselves kind of have these nice flat feet. Now, in terms of their solar allergy, this one was pretty easy to explain, in that it's going to be similar to what I was trying to discuss with the trolls and just couldn't make work with the trolls because the trolls
sucked. Thoughts exactly.
Yeah. So they've had a couple of scientists take a crack at this, so I'm basically just putting myself up on to their standing. But it'll be similar to the diseases we've discussed before, either the xeroderma pigmentosum or the solar urticaria, which I'm more likely to say it's a solar allergy, because that's what other scientists have said. So an extreme reaction to sunlight, probably driven by histamine, the kind of thing that causes allergies that we use Benadryl to try and help with. Producing sort of hives and burns across their skin, enough that like it can be healed. The Mogwai seem to take less damage from the sunlight than the gremlins do, which makes sense, since the Mogwais are covered by hair, and it seems to sort of protect them. Why, evolutionarily, they would have such a negative adaptation, I would assume is probably going to be something you guys will talk about with inbreeding or something along those lines.
Basically.
Yeah, because there really isn't any reason to have such an adaptation, but it's definitely something that we can see in nature. It would not be as significant as what happens to poor Stripe at the end of the film, where the sunlight hits him and he basically melts in a matter of seconds. Definitely possible he would suffer either extreme burns or he would be suffering sort of hive formation all over him, and it would probably put him into a state of allergic shock, that would probably be what killed him. But he wouldn't just like melt into a pile of bones and other material. There's just no reaction that could take place.
Great effect,
like that.
Too.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Yeah, really good. Yeah, yeah.
That's the thing about practical effects. They look good 40 years later. You don't need to worry about CGI crap.
There's a bit of stop motion in this, though, that doesn't hold up quite as well.
Yeah. So the replication with water, I had a little bit more difficulty, obviously, trying to explain exactly how.
Really?
Because in the film, at least, the replication with water works a lot better for what's seen with the Mogwai than it does for what's seen with the gremlin. Because in the film, a little bit of water ends up getting spilled on Gizmo. These sort of round, circular chunks of things seem to erupt from the skin, erupt from the fur.
Violently.
Violently. So much so that it's incredibly painful. They seem to shoot across the room and then quickly turn into Mogwai that are about the same size as him. This can't work. You can't have them turn into something the same size as him. There's no explanation of where they would be getting the biomass for such a thing. However, because we're Cinematica Animalia and we try to make these things work the best that we can, the sort of most fun way that I had of trying to get this to work would actually be combining a couple of the diseases that we've talked about before in terms of discussing a combination of a type of allergy to water called aquagenic urticaria and combining the brine shrimp that we've talked about before. So if the Mogwai, if Gizmo did produce sort of cysts, sort of little versions of himself that were simply spread into the dermis and were sort of stored in a dehydrated, almost sporulated form, and were kept in such a way that they were separated from the rest of his tissues and the rest of his skin, such that when he drank water, they're not necessarily getting moisture, and they were hidden underneath his fur, sort of in the form of like these little bumps or other things like that, then theoretically, when these were struck with water, they might end up coming out of their cysts, they might end up undergoing metabolic processes that would eventually lead to the generation of live young. Now, this would be...
I have an alternative explanation, and I think it's...
Okay.
Yeah, but we'll get into that in the ecology
Sure.
section.
This would be incredibly difficult. It's very hard to do for a mammal. I don't think this method would work all that well. It works really, really well for very simple life, but to actually have some sort of mammalian organism generated underneath the skin. The only other thing that I could think of was trying to pull something from Sam's culture, which would be the idea that the Mogwai do give birth to live youngs that are too immature to actually form. And basically...
Yes,
crawl.
This is exactly what I think is happening. Yeah.
And would crawl up and basically hide themselves underneath the fur, sort of all across Gizmo, and would move into a much less metabolically active state until exposed to water, which would cause them to sort of fall off. That would mean that theoretically Gizmo would have small nipples or some sort of arrangement underneath his fur that we just can't see. And that would be what these young are basically like feeding off of. I'm not quite sure why water would be the trigger to activate and cause them to sort of fall free. But in that situation, they would then end up becoming active. Now, they would start off as very basic young. They'd be incredibly immature. They would probably still need to feed on Gizmo for a period of time. None of this makes sense that they would shoot off and quickly generate into their current forms.
No.
But there are some ways that we could potentially make it work such that we do have young that are sort of hanging off Gizmo at all times.
Yep. Yeah, and we'll go into that in a bit more, because I have some ideas on that. None of them that work particularly well, but, you know, plausible kind of, oh, maybe this could work, but just not in this extreme circumstance.
Yeah, and I mean, Gizmo would have to lose a lot of mass for this, and there's no way that it would produce evil versions of himself.
Yes,
or herself.
They don't even have mustaches, so how do you know that they're evil?
Yeah, they need goatees. Yeah. Goatees are the new mustache.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of the life stages, and Sam and I have had a lot of discussions about this, the kind of feeding after midnight... there's absolutely no way that you can trigger a metabolic process based on an arbitrary time. All right, time is very much a human construct. It doesn't really work in the environmental field in terms of having this like strict midnight as a period of time where like, ooh, that's what triggers them to like form.
I have an idea for how that might work. Maybe not physiologically, but you get Gizmo first off from this old Chinese man who, for all we know, is living in, or at least originally from Hong Kong, because that's where Cantonese is mainly. But in China, besides the big cities on the coast, a lot of it is still very much a third world country. And you have these areas that have really, they're still very rural. They could have a lot of more primitive ideas about the world and how things work. And there could be an area where the Mogwai are from, because that's a Chinese word itself, a Cantonese word. It's one of the many, many, many Chinese languages. And you have these people, maybe these kind of the old wise men or the old wise women of the village that are in charge of raising these rare creatures. And they just kind of know that if you feed them too much, it's going to trigger this growth into their next stage. And so they just kind of say, like, yeah, feed them during the day, it's fine. But if you feed them all day and all night, they're going to then grow, be able to grow and get to this violent stage. And for whatever reason, okay, it maybe gets lost in translation that means don't feed them after midnight. So no, don't feed them so much.
Yeah. But yeah, and just gets... this is exactly, Adam, what I thought in terms of the big thing is that the Mogwai don't seem to transform until they're fed extremely large volumes of food, with the exception being the one that's in the lab that only eats the single sandwich. But the other
very protein-rich sandwich, maybe.
And that's the other possible trigger, is that we don't actually see Gizmo consuming meat at any earlier phase in the film. And when the meat is brought out and it's given to the gremlins, that's the big thing. They're eating chicken wings, and the sandwich itself has a big old slice of ham right in the center of it.
Just a plate full of chicken legs in the fridge. No cover, nothing.
Nothing, just like, hey, we just made these. They're randomly sitting there. Go nuts. So
always
I think
happens
it's...
in some American shows or movies for whatever reason.
Right. So if either of these are the things, it's exactly the same as a caterpillar, in terms of a caterpillar needs to consume a certain amount of material before it allows itself to pupate and eventually get into that format. That's why they eat constantly. They're building up the material that's necessary for such an energetically costly procedure, the transformation.
And if this now, is the case, then the Mogwai are larvae, because when you have this juvenile stage that goes through an inactive pupal stage to then a different looking adult, it's larvae, pupa, adult.
Yeah.
Yeah, but there's no, as we've discussed, there's no true metamorphosis.
So that's the thing that Sam and I both had the discussion. They don't actually transform. There isn't like a big conversion.
There's no change in the body plan.
Yeah, so body plan is still, but there are big shifts. So the Mogwais go from about a foot to approximately 3 feet. There is an extension of all their digits. Their feet change from being flat-footed like humans to almost a talon-like structure, like what you'd see in sort of a chicken or, you know, a dinosaur. And we end up also seeing like the jaw format, all of their teeth shift from sort of incisors to very, very carnivorous canines pretty much all the way through. Eye color changes, all the hair is lost, and the skin seems to thicken and hyperkeratinize. So what Sam and I sort of settled as a middle ground is if they are undergoing a very, very energetically costly process that's happening very, very rapidly, the crystallis might be some method where they can secrete mediums and proteins to allow them to undergo changes really quickly, because it's hard to grow once you're outside the womb. It takes a while. You're constantly fighting the environment. You're constantly fighting changes in moisture. And it's actually a lot easier to grow and to develop and to heal in a moist environment than it is to deal in a very, very dry or harsh environment.
Right.
So if they're creating something to protect them during this shift and this change, where basically all of these processes take place that would normally happen as they age, but they're undergoing it very, very rapidly, that might be the reason why. Now, this really...
Yeah, and I think those massive kind of cocoon eggs are something that they are actually constructing themselves. I don't think it's anything that, like, grows around.
No. Yes. And it might be something that they're secreting in terms of, and then they're basically allowing themselves into this format. It still doesn't make all that much sense. I mean, caterpillars can change because of, again, they have an exoskeleton. They can basically knock everything down to this mush that completely reconstructs into a different creature. We're still not completely sure how.
Some people think they're completely different organisms that have just really tightly co-evolved to kind of transition at that one point.
Yeah. And I mean, that was also something I played with, was that
weird
idea.
Right?
Yeah. Now, in terms of like the shift, the other thing I can't explain is why these cocoons rupture and they're giving off gas. Like,
and
they
light.
Give off like Yeah, and they give off like almost this foamish material. Again, none of that would make sense.
And again, there's gas that gets given off when water goes on Gizmo.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, implied to be like burning or steam, right, or
which
something.
Which is why
it seems to cause really him a lot of pain, or it a lot of pain.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and we can go into that later, because I, like I said, I have some theories on it.
Okay.
That.
And as I said,
in addition to the gas, there's also this green light that happens not only with the chrysalis, but also when Stripe goes into the pool and there's just that bubbling green something.
Right. And
their
only
blood's dark green.
I think he's just changed the color of the water.
Right. And the only thing that produces a bright color like that in nature is luciferin. In terms of, like, if you've got some sort of... And there's no reason for a luciferin reaction to be taking place. It's incredibly energy costly to generate that kind of light. You're not going to undergo such a process. Unless they've got phosphorus bound in their tissues or something, and they're having a horrible reaction to water, which would be the only thing...
That'd be more yellow, though. Or white,
yeah, white,
right?
White phosphorus, yeah. Yeah, so, again, doesn't really work... A lot of that stuff, maybe they're secreting something, that they're forming sort of this makeshift chrysalis to allow fluid to be excreted and to go through a stage more similar to what would be seen in utero, but it's still not a good mechanism. It still leaves them incredibly vulnerable during that period of time, and evolutionarily, I think it's what you guys would struggle to explain.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
You could
so,
say that.
Yeah, okay. Because that's the thing. You can't break down bone. So, moving on in terms of the gremlins, in terms of just a quick general physiology, the transformation, as we discussed, leads them to about 3 feet in height. They generate
and their
these
legs switch.
Yeah, their feet actually shift over. Their teeth go from the normal incisors to basically carnivores all the way through. Incredibly
right.
Carnivorous dentition.
But I mean, not just like the feet, and not from like the flat foot to more of like a clawed, grippy foot, but they go from what looks like a human-like leg with the one knee joint and then your ankle and your foot kind of way towards the bottom to having more of like a dog leg-looking structure with the reverse knee.
I think a lot of this is just hidden by the fact that they've got massive amounts of fur. I don't think there's as many physiology changes as we see. Because, I mean, have you ever seen a fucking poodle when it's been shaved?
Yeah.
Yes.
They look like a fucking goanna, okay? It's a very different-looking animal.
Anyways.
I think...
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Their fingers elongate. They still keep up 3 digits on both, like, hands and feet, but they end up generating these incredibly sharp and durable claws. Their GI transforms to a point where they can basically eat anything.
Jaws and extend.
And their eye color shifts. They go from, like, the Mogwai white to sort of a red with a slitted eye. And then their skin, they become hairless, thickened, and also their skin is extremely durable. In terms of, we see Gizmo literally falls off the bed into a hamper, and we end up having to bandage his head because he's so badly hurt. And meanwhile, like, Stripe gets like knocked across the floor, and gets like he accidentally hits himself with other material, and like they get set on fire. They are incredibly durable little guys.
Yeah, even just the blowback from a pistol should break his hand.
They are fast. They are so fast, and way faster than the Mogwais. Their behavior seems to shift to become bloodthirsty, destructive, and their intelligence becomes very high. They're seen rewiring electrical lights to like everything.
Yeah. It was already pretty high when they were Mogwai because they fuck up the clock because they know that it's going to get that guy to feed him later than they should be fed. And it can even Gizmo is imitating human speech.
But you or I would know to, like, pull the electric cords loose to shut off something, but the idea of actually rewiring it to get a desired effect...
Oh, with the traffic lights. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. It's a nasty sensation in terms of... So the big things that I wanted to talk about, their primary, because there's a whole bunch of cool stuff to talk about, but the big ones that I wanted to discuss were, first, their eyes, in terms of they undergo a slitted and eye color change. And I think this is for nocturnal hunting. So
I have some ideas about that.
Perfect. So
I think they're nocturnal in general.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so a slitted eye, in terms of, a lot of people ask, you know, why do cats have a slitted eye? It's because they are a nocturnal hunter. So
because it looks
cool. Opposed to, our pupil is allowed to change about 15-fold in terms of like the constriction, which allows some variation in terms of we get some night vision in terms of what we're allowed. However, a cat's slitted eye, because of the way that it's built and because it's a slit, not a circular pupil, they're capable of undergoing a 135 to 300-fold change. So that gives them a huge amount of night vision in terms of what they're capable, and they can work under multiple fields of multiple light, giving them a lot more capabilities in dark to semi-dark environments.
Do we ever see any eye shine from the gremlins?
They don't. There seems to be more of an absorption, and I think that's also why they undergo the color change. So we don't fully understand why, but in a lot of species, for example, owls, owls actually have different color changes based on the time of day that they hunt. So owl species that hunt in the dark seem to have dark pupils that don't absorb much light, and it's basically for like the type they're going, or sorry, go for maximum absorption of light. Owls that hunt during the day have almost a yellow pupil with like a less absorption, and those that hunt during the middle ground, kind of the dusk to evening sort of dawnish arrangement, and have more of a variation in terms of the times that they hunt in terms of the variability of light, have an orange to red color, the same color that's adopted by the gremlins. We still don't understand why orange seems to be the preferred color for animals that want to hunt sort of in a whole variety of
absorbs the most light, maybe.
Maybe. But in this situation, the gremlins take on the same color as seen with predators that hunt in those various time periods. And then the second big thing that I wanted to talk about was the skin transformation, in terms of they move to sort of a hyper-keratinized, very thickened skin. And there's a couple of explanations for that in terms of why they lose all their hair. So the couple of big things, the first of which is that the skin has become far too thickened for hair follicles to exist. So, for example, the palms of our hands are incredibly hyperkeratinized tissue, or what's seen kind of around the outside of the lips. That area actually can't grow hair because it's too thick for hair follicles to grow in. So instead, we aim for protection, and we see that with a lot of animals, like, for example, the rhino, in terms of one, for heat-sensitive purposes, you don't need the hair, but two, you just end up going for a hyper-thickened structure to try and protect yourself.
Or like Sam's point for the last episode of the Doctor Who guys, the heel on your grandparents.
Yes.
Oh.
Now, Sam's fetish. The other explanation is that basically the transformative process that they went through has rendered them in a state where the hair just simply hasn't grown in yet. And they're running around completely hairless because they underwent this huge change with lengthening and changes to the skin. And they might eventually grow in hair similar to a Mogwai. They just don't live long enough for us to actually see them do it. And then the last sort of cool explanation was that their metabolic rate is just way too high. In terms of if their metabolic rate, because they consume everything. They are constantly eating throughout the entire film. Their metabolic rate must have increased multiple times over what's seen with the Mogwai in terms of how quick they run, in terms of how quick they move, and in terms of how hungry they seem to be. So if that's the case, they might just be producing so much body heat that they're not able to maintain hair, and there's no purpose for it. If they stay warm at all these situations because they fucking eat everything, then they don't need the hair. And then the last sort of cool one that I guess I quickly wanted to touch on would just be the change in their GI, in terms of the gremlins go to a period where they're eating everything. And I mean, like, everything that comes about. Like, we see them. Yeah, and actually it turns down the croissant. The croissant's sitting on top of the table, and the one in Dr. Hansen's office goes, "Egh!" and throws the croissant away. I think it's a croissant. And ends up taking the glass beaker down off the table, and then we hear like, "Ugh, yummy," and like consumes the glass.
Yum, yum.
Yeah, and it's so...
I did enjoy all the
right?
I bet you did.
It's really interesting. So if they are taking on this behavior, they're going to have dentition more than just the carnivorous teeth that we're seeing. Or like birds or other reptiles, as Adam would say, they are taking on a gastrolith structure.
Because I'm right.
They've got a muscularized crop or something else that's developed, and they're using all of this, like the hard material that they're consuming, not for the purposes of actually eating it, but for the purposes of having it there to help grind up a lot of everything else that they're eating.
Takes a lot to digest the Snickers.
2 minute noodles, man, real bad for you.
So that's the physiology. I tried to keep it short and sweet this time so we can move on to the ecology.
Yes.
You did a great job.
Yes, and look.
Long story short, the
this
ecology
was a real
is
mother bitch
fucked.
Of a week. Yeah, I think we know how Dave felt during
the trolls
during
that
the
fucking
the trolls
the best episode ever.
Yeah. Look, yeah, I that was great for us that episode, but this has been a real real problem. So the three things we're going to go through are life history, their behavior, and then how they evolved to get these traits. Because I have. No idea. Like, for starters, yeah, we'll touch on what Dave was talking about before. We know it's not clonal growth, which is the thing that everybody kind of assumes because, you know, they look exactly like him, but they
don't. And they're not exactly like, there's a lot of diversity, yeah. There's a lot of variation going on, which, when you have clones, it is the exact same as the parent, which some organisms do, and they're usually smaller organisms that are more, that people tend to think of as less complex, even though they're very complex organisms in and of themselves. Things like aphids do this, Daphnia, which are sea fleas. They're mostly invertebrates, and large invertebrate animals don't do this.
Yeah, there's no mammals that use clonal growth. So I think what we have is a situation like Dave was talking about before, where Gizmo, whether female or male, had already given birth. He has a modified version of a pouch, like a marsupial does, on his back. Most tree-dwelling marsupials, like possums or koalas, have it on their front. However, there's all sorts of weird adaptations with pouches, so it's odd that it would be on the back, but fine, whatever.
It could make sense if it's on the back, these are more either arboreal, they live in the trees and they hunt around at night, or maybe they even live in caves with low light towards the mouth of a cave.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. Like, all arboreal mammals, all arboreal marsupials have pouches on the front.
But are these arboreal in the sense that they're able to keep their body away from the trunk wherever they're climbing on? Because if these guys don't have very long arms, so maybe they're scraping along really hard along the trees wherever they're climbing.
Yes.
And it would be disadvantageous to have your young there.
Yes, that's what I'm thinking, yeah. And so I would say there's been an adaptation, and I would say that also there's a thinning of the skin over the pouch, because normally you'd have a species climb out, but these seem to be popping through the skin. So I would say that initially you would have very thick skin.
Everywhere else except for that area. Thinned
over time. Say again.
Everywhere else. Maybe it's a case like we have, like with some marsupials, like the kangaroo, where they have this basically a movable fetus crawls out into the pouch area, and then the skin forms over it.
Yes.
Or it's thin enough that they can burrow and through it and just stay there.
Yeah. And then I would say it's very thick skin initially because they have to protect these creatures that are on their backs, which are vulnerable to attack. And then the skin thins and they burst through it, kind of like, I don't know if you guys have ever
seen the video of a
Surinam toad. Yeah. If you have trypophobia, which my partner has a mild version of, yeah, do not watch this video. But if you want to see some really cool shit, the Surinam toad lays eggs in the back of the male of the species. That lays eggs that are then come out the back in little froglets pop out the back, and it is, for me, it is so satisfying to watch. I love watching
it. I can't stand it. It's disgusting. Oh. It makes my skin crawl.
For me, it is.
Ugh.
Well, it makes their skin crawl too. Hey!
Makes their skin shoot off into this nasty, disgusting mesh of disgusting skin. It's disgusting. Ugh.
Well, I think it looks amazing. Anyway, but, yeah, Surinam toad.
But wait, is it Suriname?
Definitely worth looking up. I have no idea. Anyway, regardless, the problem is exactly what Dave said before. Look, I'm happy with them coming out of the pouch into like a fully formed version of themselves, but not that big.
No, they couldn't.
Because I mean, you see a joey come out of a kangaroo's pouch; it looks like a kangaroo. As opposed to the little kind of, you know, red rocket that it looks like when it's in the pouch, but it's still a very small version of a kangaroo.
Can't really fend for itself too well. I mean, as far as life history goes and why this kind of would be an adaptation, what I'm thinking is that it has to do with dispersal and resource availability. So you have this parent Mogwai, be it male, female, hermaphroditic, whatever, and it has the ability to move around, to acquire resources itself, to be active. But you have either these like not formed siblings or these actual young that are on its back that it's carrying around. When it's able to find resources like water, that triggers these babies or siblings to come popping off to then grow themselves.
Yes.
Or if they're in a really, really bad place and these haven't eaten for a long time, they're able to acquire a lot of resources all at once. They switch over to this violent, crazy, fast, strong predator type phenotype. They can then go even further. It's more intelligent. It knows where to settle down, and somehow it gets back to that cute bird stage.
Yeah, and I think that's the direction you guys are going to be going.
Yeah, yeah, and we'll get into that a little bit later. But just to finish off this kind of life history section, that metamorphosis, we've already talked about this. I think those cocoons are constructed by themselves to transition into a different stage of their life history.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, and I think that life history is, so evolutionary-wise, we'll get into the evolutionary biology now. If you have a creature that undergoes some sort of transformation like this, it's generally because they're using different parts of the ecosystem at different times in their life, which is really beneficial. So yeah, Dave and I were talking about this before. Gizmo, he looks a lot like, I think he's like kind of a cross between an opossum and a tarsier. A tarsier being a small kind of primate that they find mainly in southern Africa and Madagascar.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think, yeah. And so I think, yeah, the mammals are tree dwelling, arboreal, and then they would, I don't know, even potentially just be herbivorous, eating insects, that sort of thing as well. And marsupials and other mammals as well, they have this, they have the ability to trigger reproduction when there is an abundance of resources. So kangaroos can self-terminate pregnancies whenever there's too little water around. I think that that's what's going on here. It's just far too acute a reaction. Like, you can't just have water and all of a sudden you're like, yeah, okay, there's water around, I can reproduce now.
Right. Even evolutionarily speaking, we could go even more extreme and say they're not arboreal. They could be more of a cave-dwelling organism. Because that way, if they're living in constant darkness, or at least low light, there is no disadvantage to having those the genes that code for that xeroderma pigmentosum, or this sun allergy, if it builds up in a nocturnal or a cave-dwelling system, it's not going to be disadvantageous. There's nothing selecting against it. So then they're either...
I think they're more likely to be living in tree hollows.
Yeah, yeah. That also makes sense. Very, very low light.
Yeah.
They're going to have incredible predation then, if they're going to be basically trying to get back into the darkness before the sunlight comes up and whatever is hunting them.
Yeah. That, or it's just the case they live.
I think it's
they live in areas where there's just so much prey availability, or so many trees around they can eat, or they have such a wide breadth of their diet. It's not as big of an issue as you might think.
Yeah. So I think that they, for me, it would be an evolution. They have to have evolution in a temperate zone, right? Because they have to have evolved in a temperate zone because they are going to be very short-lived creatures, because they're incredibly aggressive. There's lots of activity. If you have a high metabolic rate during your life, it generally leads to a much shorter lifespan.
Right.
I think, given this transformation, they have a lifespan of about 1 year, and that change into the gremlin is triggered towards the end of winter.
Yep.
When it gets much warmer, losing all that fur is very advantageous, and they can be more active. So I think that they're mainly subsisting on insects and leaves and bugs and that sort of stuff that hide in trees. Like I said, acting like primates, like IIs or tarsiers do. Just feeding on bugs at the start of their life. And then they grow when the summer hits. There's a lot more food around. And then they become less tree-based. Can move around a lot more and feed on rodents. Birds.
Other mogwai.
Potentially. Although I don't really think so. Look, I don't know where they've evolved, because it has to be temperate forests, but they can't have evolved in Australia because there's
China.
Too much other competition there.
China works.
So, yeah, but that's how, do they have temperate forests in China?
Yes.
So you're thinking northern China?
Yeah.
Yes, and that's exactly what I was thinking as well.
But then they can't be marsupials, so why do they have pouches?
But they could be if they were just
It might not be a true pouch.
Right.
Or this could be a rare example of convergence in a group outside of marsupials.
Right. Or just...
That has just never been seen.
But they have to be either marsupials or primates. I was thinking either a primate that has evolved to be... But you can't have a primate evolve to be more like a marsupial. Because...
Why not?
That's just stupid.
Marsupials
are one of the dumbest animals in the world.
Yeah, they're
right?
They're nature's handicap.
There is no advantage to
anything
evolving to be
idea.
More like a marsupial.
What we could say
so
is...
So I was thinking that it was a marsupial that developed more like a primate. So a possum that developed more intelligence and just stayed up in the trees, got a bit slower. Like I said, same sort of thing filling the niches of Tarsier or an II. However, they would have had to have occurred on an island somewhere. China makes sense, but then... How did the primate get... Because all the original primates So all the primates that are even vaguely similar to this. So they don't resemble any monkeys.
Mm-mm.
They don't resemble any of the great apes.
They resemble some very small
monkeys. Tarsier's eyes that these guys are. Say again?
There are some small monkeys that are like the size of your hand or maybe even a little bit bigger. They kind of look like the Mogwai. Yeah, and there are primates in China. Are,
like I said, Tarsier's eyes. What's that? What's the other small ones?
The golden mane.
Lemurs, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
It could also be the most basic version of primates.
I thought you were getting at the TJs.
Yeah. That's this whole episode. This isn't Gremlins. This is actually TJs. Because what you mentioned earlier with their fur, at least at the Mogwai stage, hiding a lot of their bodies. And it could be that there isn't even a pouch. It's just a case of these little fur balls that are fur anyway, so they blend in very well. That could just be hanging onto the back, period.
Yeah, but they're going to have, unless they're doing something similar to a pangolin, where like they will actually just hang off of the parent. But like the problem is, we do think they have to have some sort of nipple structure. And if you've got some sort of nipple structure, you most likely, for latching purposes, want some sort of secondary structure to protect your young, or at least hide them.
This is the thing. I have no... If they've evolved in northern China, like, what have they evolved from?
Yeah.
If they're down in, like, the... Because the part of the world that has temperate forests that is on the right side of the Wallace Line. The Wallace Line, we've talked about this before. It's a line running through the continent of Australasia that has no marsupials on one side and all the marsupials on the other side, apart from opossums, which are their own little fucker. If they've evolved in, like, temperate, bordering on the temperate tropical forest in Australia, like, they must have evolved on an island somewhere, because otherwise they'd be everywhere in Australia. Their evolutionary history makes sense until you have to wonder about where it's like... Well, even then... No, until you have to wonder about where it's come from.
Yeah, well, and the transformation as well in terms of how that would benefit which environment and...
Yeah, well, dispersal. But I mean, the transformation I just think is, you have an abundance of resources that all of a sudden pops up. So that's a trigger to go into the next stage. But it's too acute.
It's also the problem of the Mogwai themselves don't seem to be great gatherers. They don't seem to fulfill any role where we would expect them. Like, they don't seem to be... Like, it's kind of a dodo bird situation. Like, you're staring at them and you're like...
No, I think that's a product of domestication.
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
If you have a species that you have inside... This happens with everything. Fish, birds, you feed them, you house train them, they lose the ability to look out for predators.
Watch it!
They don't even know how to feed themselves.
You're going after my entire profession here.
Yeah, you have these useless people to look after them. It could be a case of we don't really get a sense of how they are reproducing if they are, because we don't think they're going to be completely asexual. So there has to be some kind of sexual reproduction going on, so they have this recombination of their genes. And it could be like a lot of insects where you have this larval stage that looks fairly similar to the adult, but there's some obvious difference, morphological differences, where like for all these aquatic insects, they're predators in the water. They have the long spindly legs. They look crazy and alien. Then when they get out of the water, they have wings. They can disperse and reproduce, and they die. They don't last very long in that stage, which is kind of what we're saying about the Mogwai and the Gremlin. So it could be there is something with reproduction going on during the Gremlin stage. They're crazy fast. They're smart. They'll know where to go. They know how to get resources. They can, if they even are trying to get resources, because at least for like with these insects, because they don't last very long at this adult stage. They're not concerned with eating that much. They just want to reproduce, die, continue the cycle.
Yeah, so I think that, there's a lot of issues this week. But this is, the next one is the big one. They're too smart.
They're too fucking smart. They're smarter than human children.
Yeah, and
from
I couldn't,
the get-go.
I had no explanation for this in the physiology either.
I think maybe it's just mimicry. Maybe they're just incredibly good at mimicking things, but they're picking it up.
And they're contextualizing it, and they're using it in the proper formats. They're verbing, like they have proper sentence structure.
They put on outfits. They're caroling. They know words to songs.
Yeah,
there's one puts on fucking makeup.
Balaclava.
Yeah.
The makeup is the bigger problem.
Like, it's got a wig on. It's wearing a dress. It put makeup on its lips. It's sitting next to one that's wearing a suit. They're being all fancy and playing cards.
They can read.
They are playing cards. Yeah.
Because Stripe looks over at the candy store and goes, "Ooh, candy," and heads over.
Yeah.
So not only is he capable of reading, but he's capable.
They're smoking cigarettes. They're drinking. They're operating a tap at the bar.
But again, a lot of that can be put down to mimicry. Even the candy thing, like, that could just be word association with the smell.
Right, but, like, these have literally just been born. They have not seen any humans doing this shit.
He's sounding it out, though.
But Tarsier babies can be very capable after, like, one or two
days. Can they jump in a tractor, start it up, and mow down a poor farmer and his wife in their
living
room?
Oh, my God! No, they cannot. That is such a horrid scene.
With that upbeat Christmas music going on.
There's a gremlin in my cab!
This is, it's just impossible. Right. Like, so much of this, I have no idea. This is the first time that I was completely stumped.
So, Sam, do I get to do my theory then?
What's your theory?
And we discussed this at the beginning. That when
looking forward to this.
Yeah, so Sam and I were talking about this quickly before the broadcast, and I was trying to put together, like, why these Mogwai would look like this. And the big theory that I ended up coming up as the movie was going on, I think that they're a Chinese super weapon. I think they are.
I think they are
a genetically engineered, because, like, he brings up, he's like, yeah, they end up putting these things in our vehicles and they end up destroying us. If the Chinese had designed a super cute little furry creature that seemed pretty helpless, all North Americans would take it into their home, right? You'd encourage it.
Pokemon.
Yeah, you'd bring it to the military base. You'd do all that. Then they get fed big American or big British meals, where they just get, like, a ton of food because they're like those Americans. They just eat everything. A
ton of calories.
Yeah, these things then turn overnight into these horrible monsters that run around kicking the shit out of everything. They replicate really, really easily. And then the Chinese are like, and at the end, when we want to wipe them out, we just go in with UV lights. It was like, I was thinking that, and I was like, this is perfect. And even at the end, where, like, the Mr. Wing comes and, like, picks up the creature.
Speaks to him in Cantonese, and it stops.
And the creature is talking to him at the end, and he keeps referring to him as Papa. And I'm like, that's it. Mr. Wing is a secret geneticist. He built these things to wipe out the Americans and then felt bad about it. And he's been like, no, I won't do this.
But, and as, like, we know from the recent crimes of gay wizard Hitler, if you have a wonky eye, you're obviously a villain.
Yes. So,
heterochromia, right?
Yeah.
Heterochromia,
yeah.
So clearly, yeah, it was like, yep, nope, they're a secret Chinese super weapon. That's the only reason they're so damn cute. Okay.
You know, that makes more sense than all of what we just said.
Okay, so I think that's it for us, right? Is there anything else we want to talk about ecology-wise?
They seem to have some kind of dominance hierarchy. Stripe definitely seems to be the...
I would say they live in, like, packs or colonies. Troops. What do you call... troops, yep. The Kenpool is my Senpool's juicy sweet. Our only wish... Okay, so on to the verses then.
Yeah.
Right, so I've got a verses for this week. So I was thinking, you know, this small spindly creature, quite evil, always getting up to mischievous. So why not put Stripe and his original four gremlins up against Gollum?
Ooh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I thought Gollum would easily take out one gremlin, because Gollum has...
We've seen him smash a fish.
A higher level of intelligence. Exactly, yeah. That
he likes to strangle.
But what if we've got, you know... Gollum's in an environment that he's not familiar with, so he's walked into the Christmas house instead of... Mrs. Randall. Instead of Mrs. Randall...
Peltzer!
Gollum has walked into the kitchen. Instead of Mrs. Peltzer... Gollum has walked into the kitchen, seen these things fucking up, and immediately, you know, he's like, oh, I don't like these things.
Trixies! Little Trixies! We must kill them, we must!
Anyway, he sees them, he's like, right, gotta take those out. They see him as a threat,
they just want to kill everything.
Four gremlins, one Gollum.
I feel like Gollum's got this.
About to say.
I don't know, man, those...
No, but Gollum's...
Gollum's never seen a gun
Gollum's
before.
But Gollum's in the kitchen?
Gollum's walking towards the kitchen. The gremlins are there. They've got the weapons with them. So they've got access to the knives.
Gollum has these big spindly hands he loves to strangle things with. And he's really quick.
I feel like Gollum's brutality is something we never see the gremlins quite match. In terms of, like, they're brutal and they're scary. But Gollum
would
be like...
They're mean, but they're not homicidal. Except for Stripe, they're not homicidal maniacs.
Gollum is sitting on top of these, like, pounding the one gremlin's face in with the juice mixer while he's simultaneously getting, like...
But there's four of them.
Well, he has these weird...
What if there's a turkey carver?
Feet.
We know they can use a chainsaw. What if there's a turkey carver
But here's a better question. Does Gollum get access to the Shave-O-Matic 5000?
Ooh. Well, I think we can take it as a given that they are going to be exploring these inventions like they were in the movie. He's probably going to get at least one of them off just by pressing a button or smashing or something or pushing them onto a blade.
Gollum's never seen technology before. Gollum's never seen this sort of technology before. They have. They know how to use this sort of shit.
The fact that the mum demolished like four of them, I feel like Gollum is going to be able to get...
They didn't see her coming, though. At least one of them didn't.
Okay, so I guess it depends, but I feel like Gollum usually surprises.
And he's they're tenacious. Capable of setting traps to these things, you know? Like, they're capable...
And Gollum's hardy.
Okay.
He's hardy. And, hey, okay. Better question. With a rock,
he'll still come bite your finger off.
Yeah, does Gollum think that Stripe has his precious?
We can assume that that's why he's looking. He right. thinks it's in this area.
Because then everything's fucked at that point. Yeah. Gollum is just gonna wipe his way through anything in his path.
But does Smeagol want to kill them? Because that's a problem that he's gonna have. Smeagol might think these could possibly be cute, or maybe he sees a picture of Gizmo in the house.
No, it's definitely Gollum. This is Gollum. Gollum's
not going to see it as cute. Gollum's going to bite the head.
Gollum's going to kill everything.
Yes.
And he'll probably want to try to eat them.
Okay, Gollum.
I feel like Gollum's got this week.
Okay.
He'll be bloodied. He'll be bit to shit. He'll be punched up. He's tenacious, and he will stop at nothing to kill.
I thought you were gonna do John McClane for a second there, and I was like, ooh, okay.
That was my suggestion.
No. Yeah. Well, no, I wanted to do Gollum. Right. Yeah. Anyway, so that is it from us, and this is the last episode of Cinematic Animalia for this season. We will be back next year, but in the meantime, we will have a fun little episode for you in the next couple of weeks. Just to sign off with a royal playoff between the eight winners. Right. Big old playoff. We'll have a series of entertaining matches. It'll be a little half hour episode to say goodbye. Thanks everyone for listening. We will be back in probably mid-January next year. With season 2 and a brand new format. In the meantime, if you want to listen to any of our old episodes, they're all available on cinematicaanimalia.com. As always, you can find us on Apple Podcasts. Hopefully by next year we'll be on Google Play. We have no idea what's going on there, but it doesn't seem to be working.
It's fucked.
But you can always find us on SoundCloud. If you leave us a rating, tell your friends about it, that sort of thing. We really appreciate it. Thank you everyone for listening. And we will see you quite soon.
Yum yum.
Yeah, see ya.
Okay.